online at www.cheezeplease.com. I'm Uncle Skeeter, inviting you back next week as we help to spread the cheese.
This is Bird Note. Bird voices can vary tremendously. When you're learning to recognize birds by ear, it can help to have shared vocabulary to describe how they sound. For example, some birds have clear singing voices, like this American robin. The scarlet tanager's song holds a similar tune, but this bird sounds a little hoarse. The word nasal comes to mind when describing the call of a red-breasted nuthatch. While the brown-headed nuthatch comes off as squeaky. Other birds are so buzzy that they're easily mistaken for insects, like this grasshopper sparrow. Some birds sound almost mechanical, like the metallic song of the common grackle, and the simple clicking notes of a yellow rail. Then there are aficionados like song sparrows that mix and match tones in complex compositions. Learning to describe bird sounds will make it easier to figure out who's singing and to remember the voices of your favorite birds. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel.
You can deny all the things I've seen, all the things I've discovered, but not for much longer. Because too many others know what's happening out there.
I want to believe.
Hi, this is David Duchovny, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby.
Welcome to Screen Therapy. I'm your host, Jason Schurz. In October of 2018, I found myself in the hospital, sitting across from a psychiatrist who was telling me I had bipolar. I was sent home with a bunch of medication and laid on the couch for a week. I had my iTunes library on shuffle, trying to shake the hornet's nest from my head. Ever since I was a kid, I've been using loud music as a form of therapy. Punk rock and mental health have always been connected. This podcast looks at that connection through the lens of different guests. This is Screen Therapy. Throughout the ages, people have used music for healing. In a new documentary film called Heavy Healing, New York hardcore scene veteran Howie Abrams examines how punk, metal, and hardcore have been a huge part of recovering from physical and mental hardships. In the film, Howie interviews many familiar faces in the loud music world about their experiences using the power of music to soothe, inspire, motivate, and ultimately heal. Whether it's a loved one blasting punk for someone in a coma, or a hardcore band showing up to the hospital to support a good friend, the film proves how loud music can provide heavy healing.
I'm Howie Abrams, coming to you from New York City, where I was born and raised. I grew up with underground music here in the city, both metal and hardcore. I was going to hardcore shows since around 1984 and into so many of the traditional New York hardcore bands that you would expect. Fast forward a little bit, I did a fanzine and, you know, was sort of very involved with going to shows and whatnot, and wound up starting a record label around 1987 called In Effect Records. Basically put out a lot of your favorite bands, Agnostic Front and Sick of It All and Killing Time and Madball and Nuclear Assault and all kinds of bands. And then I worked at a couple of other labels, Roadrunner Records. And then I wound up leaving the label and publishing thing behind and started writing books. And I've done 10 books, all music-related stuff. And just wound up with an idea that turned into a documentary film called Heavy Healing.
So the thesis of the film, or the theme of the film, is how loud music, punk, metal, is able to help people with their health, whether that's physical or mental. And that's a pretty general concept, but from your perspective and talking to all these people for the film, why does it help?
Well, it started with Seth, right? So Seth Abrams, who I'm not actually related to, but is someone who worked in the music business and I've known for a very, very, very long time. He was like a super healthy guy, like runner, marathon runner. And so out of nowhere, and again, the story is told in the film, but out of nowhere, he had an aortic aneurysm. So his heart was bleeding for 2 days. He's in the hospital for like 3 weeks to a month. They actually patch him up. And the day he's going home, like the day he's putting clothes in a suitcase, he has a stroke. And it's as a result of the aneurysm. So what they did for him and to help him with the aneurysm actually caused a stroke. And so he's still to this day partially paralyzed. So, you know, he limps and he has a struggle with his left side. And then fast forward a little bit and he wound up having seizures. And so he lost a lot of his short-term memory, a lot of things, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, he said that when he was in the hospital after the stroke, you know, one of the doctors was talking to his family. He was still groggy from the stroke and medication and all of this stuff. And he overhears the doctor saying, you know, you're not going to walk again. You're not going to swallow again. You're not going to use your left arm again. And out of this fog, he utters the words, "You can't bring me down." And for some reason, these Suicidal Tendencies lyrics were in his head. You can't bring me down. Bring me down. You can't bring me down. Bring me down. You can't bring me down. No, bring me down. You can't bring me down. And it became his mantra for recovery. So to go to PT, to just to keep going. Like, it was such a grueling experience and recovery. And, you know, band members were coming to see him in the hospital. Like, H2O showed up and, like, they hung their, like, tour banner behind him in his bed, in his hospital bed. All these people were coming to see him. And so when he sort of had recovered quite a bit, he knew I had been doing books. And he came to me with this idea of doing a book about all these people that we knew of that either were in bands or they were fans or they were music industry types that went through something. So either they were born with something, you know, a condition, they acquired some kind of medical complication or something, mental health stuff, all of it. And let's do a book about these people. So he started working on the book. He was interviewing people. He had like Chuck Billy from Testament. And we started to realize, because of his memory loss and all of that, that maybe this would be better to do it as a documentary and film people, because hearing people tell their own stories on camera seemed to be more poignant than a book version. So that's what we did. And we sort of started making a list of all these people we knew that had been through all different kinds of things and are still going through it or whatever. And let's approach them about and interview them about their ordeal and how they used mostly aggressive music to help them through it. And so whether it was just the release of it, there's a PhD in the movie who talks about the fact that it reminds you of a time when you were more carefree and younger, right? So when you didn't care about anything and nothing bothered you and it didn't seem like there were any obstacles, that's what you were listening to as a teenager or older or still. You used it as a turning off the noise and remaining inspired and giving you energy and all of these things to get through this stuff.
Well, and that's the idea behind this podcast, Punk Rock and Mental Health. And I've talked to almost 150 people now for over the last 6 years who have similar stories, who are very much about, you know, how it's saved their life, how it's been their community, their identity. And what I've found through all this is that most people are completely fine. In fact, all of them have been completely fine with opening up about their mental health.
Kind of amazing, right? The last time we screened the movie, the person who moderated our Q&A said, how did you get people to be so candid? And I was like, you know what? Like, first of all, we knew and know everybody kind of in the movie, but they felt comfortable because it was in this context, right? Of like the music they grew up. So similar, I'm sure, to like the people you've talked to, when you frame it in this way, it made sense to like let it go and say these things.
And talk about the healing power of music. And Mike Muir from Suicidal Tendencies obviously had his own struggles over the years with mental health. And I think because punk rock's always been about saying what's on your mind and hard on the sleeve. And so there's this safe zone where, look, I can talk about this stuff. I can call myself Psycho Mico. This is okay. You know, it's a that's place right. where that's held for people.
Makes total sense. Even without the nicknames, right? It's like everybody's been through or is going through something. And just because you may have recovered from an illness, let's say, doesn't mean it's over. And there's a lot of damage that gets done, you know, not just to you, but the people around you as well. We have Lou Kohler, for instance, from Sick of It All in the movie, who's a very close friend. And like, I've known him since, you know, before there was a Sick of It All, right? Him and Pete. And, you know, so he's gone through this whole cancer ordeal. And basically, when we interviewed him for the film, it was like at a stage where he was coming up on getting his final scans, right? To find out if after treatment, after chemo, after surgery, was he in the clear? It was 4 days after he'd been told he was in remission that we interviewed him, just 4 days. It was like a success story. And it was amazing because he'd been through so much and it sort of felt like it came out of nowhere for him. One day you're like touring the world and you're in Sick of It All and you're living out this dream as you're in a hardcore band and like actually making a living and doing it with your brother and like two other friends that you've known forever. And then it's just stripped away. And so basically where it ends in the movie is he was fine and he's in remission. And less than 3 months later, it came back and it came back worse. Mm. And so now he's battling it all over again. And again, it's not a great situation. Like he has multiple tumors this time as opposed to just one the last time. And they're not shrinking the way they did the first time. And it's, you know, so it's a challenge. And he's like, even just finding the treatment that makes the most sense that helps is hard. But he does talk about everything from the nurses in the hospital thinking he's asleep, but he's listening to Motorhead. And then, all right, I listened to everything. Now I have to listen to the newer bands, you know? So he started like putting all the newer, younger hardcore bands in his rotation and like listening to all that just to like catch up.
Yeah.
So he said it kept him occupied. It kept him energized. You know, it kept him going. And sadly, he's still fighting it. It's really tough, but he talked very specifically about listening to this music to occupy his mind and not let it go, you know, wild with shitty thoughts.
Did people talk about what happens when they can't play music? You know, someone like Lou, who's been on the road for how many decades?
There weren't really any instances where people couldn't access it, right? So like Mike Nine Williams from I Hate God tells an interesting story where he had been, you know, essentially in a coma for a while because he had his transplant surgery. And he goes, I remember hearing music and I didn't know where it was coming from. People would talk to me like while I was asleep, like that whole, like, can he hear me? And he goes, But the music came through. I heard the music, and he found out his wife had put headphones on him. And so while he was in the hospital, he didn't do it, but his wife put it on. He goes, God, I remember hearing the first Descendants album. And that's what he was listening to. And he said it was amazing how that broke through like this state he was in, but he didn't remember people talking to him. He remembered the music. You know, there was no time where people couldn't have music as a part of their recovery.
Another big part of the film is the idea that some people think that punk rock and metal is noise, garbage, a waste of time,
yep,
played by people who don't know what they're doing, not real musicians, all these total myths that we know are completely untrue, but also harmful to us because this is our lives, right?
That's right.
Especially during the PMRC and getting into satanic panic is these youth that were listening to this music for healing or to enrich themselves were now being ostracized and in fact sometimes institutionalized because they were there's something wrong with them. You know, they're dressing differently. They're listening to this quote-unquote noise. So it almost had the opposite reaction to what we know as it being therapeutic.
It's interesting, too, because Jesse Leach from Killswitch Engage talks about this in the movie. His father was a pastor. And so he had very strict parents, and they had to, like, read the lyrics of what he wanted to listen to. And here's a guy who, in later years, was suicidal. On a couple of occasions, actually. And so he's very lucky he found his own will and his own voice that allowed him to just do what he was going to do. And it doesn't sound like his parents interfered so much, but you know those stories. And like you hear them, you know, about the parents that are like safeguarding their kids from these things. They don't get access to it. And they really rebel in like these over-the-top ways. So he's like, you know, the worst I did is I screamed in a band. You know what I mean? Like you drink a little too young or you smoke weed a little too young or, you know, do things like that. He goes, but I never was violent and I was never, you know, he goes, I realized in myself that there was a problem. So it took me a minute and I didn't necessarily have the language for it, you know, so I didn't understand it all that well. But he goes, once I started to be open about it and tell our fans and my bandmates and like the people around me, what was going on, you realize that there's a million of us and that ultimately the sharing of our stories and this information, it leads to you learning, you know, about your own condition and there's people doing much worse than you. And so you gain a little perspective sometimes where it's like, I have the means to get help or go to doctors and like sort of try to understand what I'm going through. Because I want to. I don't want to feel this way, right? It's not some badge of honor to walk around being bipolar, being schizophrenic, being just depressed, where you don't understand that it's like depression's like a real thing. And it's, you know, something that can be treated and worked on. And certainly the stigma thing that you shouldn't be ashamed of it.
When you were writing books, you mentioned writing quite a few books about music. Did you find this theme was coming up? Because, you know, at one point you said we should write a book about how music is related to health. But was that theme kind of popping up through the biographies you're writing and those other books?
Oh, there were definitely a few. I mean, the biggest example would be HR from Bad Brains, who was never properly diagnosed. But I think anybody could tell he was suffering from schizophrenia or bipolarity or both. His bandmates and Bad Brains were still sort of like watching all this behavior and just were taking them on tour still. There's footage of them where they did Lollapalooza in Chile. A, he looks terrible because he was always a healthy guy. He was an athlete, like all this stuff. So he always looked good, even when he was falling apart emotionally and all of this. And he's on stage the last band, I don't remember who played right before them, but it's a massive stage. It's like 60,000 people there. He's standing there in the middle of the stage, and he looks pale and skinny and just doesn't look great. And he's just talking to people that aren't there, you know, like on stage. That was the end. You know, that's where they decided we can't do this anymore. But you can ask him on Tuesday if he's got schizophrenia, and he would say yes. And then you can ask him on Wednesday, and he'd be like, oh, no. It was very challenging. But the good news is that you see through all of those things, and you see what an incredible human being is. There's a reason he was the HR that we all cherish from years gone by, and that he was so special from a lyrical point of view and from a, you know, performance, certainly maybe the greatest ever. If you were to read the transcripts of his interview, like just read it on paper, it's sort of mind-boggling, because I remember even before I was involved in the project for the book, and James, who I did the book with, had already been interviewing him like over and over again. And I think they're in Jamaica. And so he started off with like, can you just state your name, like your full birth name, right? And it's like 6 pages later and he still hasn't done it. You know what I mean? So he's just talking about what he wants to talk about. And it had nothing to do with the question. And then if you interviewed him later in the day, amazing, you know? So it was very hard to make heads or tails of him sometimes, but you did realize that it came and went, like the severity.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the real experience, I think, where you saw it and experienced it. And, you know, you're so used to seeing this guy on stage and doing backflips and being in arguably the greatest punk hardcore band of all time. And then you're sitting with him and this discussion is like so challenging. But you'd get to it, you know, but it was difficult.
As a documentarian, I think there's always characters in a film that really surprise you for whatever reason, or stand out, or step to the front. And often it's not the characters you would expect.
Yeah.
How did you feel about your film and some of the folks that were in it? Did anything surprise you or kind of take you aback?
Yeah, I don't know if there are any surprises in that context, right? But I think overall, it's something we touched on earlier, was the candor, and that people were really willing to put it out there and like say things that you might have thought, or they might have thought, could be embarrassing or could be, you know, something that people might look upon in a strange way. The one person that did something, and she talks about it in the movie, but, you know, I knew that she had done it already, is our friend Alexa, who was like the hardest skinhead chick in New York, right? Like in the 80s, like would clear the dance floor of guys, was friends with all the bands. She's a sweetheart, by the way. Just that was her thing, right? Because that was the scene in New York. It was very sort of, you know, skinhead look heavy. I mean, no like neo-Nazi stuff at all, because that just didn't fly in New York. She said things at the end of the movie. Towards the end of the movie, I let her just go, because she was talking about kindness and being remembered for those things. And one of the things that she did, she threw herself a quote unquote going away party when she knew she was going to die. And so she's like, I told people around me that I want to do this. And they said, I'm nuts. And like, you know, blah, blah, blah. But she told me, I'm like, that's a little morbid, you know? And then we go to this thing and it's the greatest celebration I've ever seen. People roasted her and talked about her craziest moments. And she paid for the whole thing. It was open bar, food, the whole thing. Hundreds of people showed up. And basically, I thought that was just an incredible thing that she did, that we all thought was crazy at first, and then realized this is maybe the greatest thing anyone's ever done. And then at the end of the movie, she's just talking about, if people are going to remember me for something, I want them to remember being generous.
In the Scream Therapy book, The phrase punk rock saved my life comes up as a theme, and it's literal in some cases. You know, sometimes punk rock can save someone from dying by suicide. Oftentimes it's just a feeling or a statement we make to explain that our lives would not be the same, or we might have gone down a much more destructive path.
Sure.
Your film's called Heavy Healing, and how did that name come about?
Well, again, it goes back to something we discussed a little bit, which was like putting this music in a positive light. And the concept of when people are in a position where they need to recover from something, it could be addiction, it could be cancer, it could be mental health challenges, that at the end of the day, you're trying to find a better place for yourself emotionally, physically, all of it. And so all of it was just healing. And that's the process that you're going through. Call it recovery. It could have been heavy recovery. It doesn't sound as good, I guess. You know, but that's what it is. And again, this music that we were growing up being told isn't music and it's trash and all that stuff. And then look at all these people relying on it. At one point, we were just like, God, we can keep going with the interviews, but we probably should stop because it's too many at this point. It's going to sound weird, but like people were popping out of the woodwork, you know, approaching us like, can I be interviewed? And I had to say things like, you know, we have too much cancer already. It was just getting like to that point, you know, where you could have just done the whole movie about cancer. We could have done the entire thing about mental health because there's so many people. I had to be like, I don't really want to be interviewed and I have my own mental health story, you know, but I don't want to, you know, seem like we did this for me or anything like that. Let me just stay behind the scenes and not be a part of that. Seth's story was a whole other animal because it really inspired the entire thing. But yeah, I think it really is all healing that we cover. And there's so many different types of stories and things that people go through. And, you know, again, some were born with something. Some got sick. There were people who we were going to maybe interview who had gotten hit by a car and lost a limb and things like that. So the mental health thing, I think, is for everybody, actually. I think everybody who went through something physical, you know, has a mental health component to their story.
Yeah.
Some people told it, some people, you know, stuck to the physical or whatever, but it's healing. That's what it is. It's like whatever it takes.
That was my conversation with Howie Abrams of Heavy Healing, Instagram.com/heavy_healing_film. For more episodes of Screen Therapy, go to ScreenTherapyHQ.com or wherever you listen to podcasts. The Screen Therapy book is available now. Screen Therapy, A Punk Journey Through Mental Health, tells my story and the stories of others who use punk as a catalyst for mental health. Like this podcast, it links the community-minded punk scene with the mental wellness of the punks who belong to it. To order the book, go to ScreenTherapyHQ.com. For merch, check out ScreenTherapy.threadless.com. Okay, enough promoting. It's time for some thanking. Thank you for listening to Screen Therapy. Doing this podcast and talking to folks about punk rock and mental health has been a crucial part of my own mental stability, and it means so much to me that you're out there listening. Screen Therapy is created in the Cathet region of coastal British Columbia, Canada, on the traditional territory of the Klahaman Nation. Contact me at ScreenTherapyHQ.com or email me at ScreenTherapyPodcast@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. Let's talk about punk rock and mental health. Until next time, take care and be well.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU Burnaby.
You're listening to CJ.